The National Party's released education policy on the teaching of reading and writing in primary and intermediate schools. The same week, a government document redefining the curriculum has also been released, termed a common practice model. It comes in the context of falling performance by New Zealand students in reading and maths by international standards. The National Party's, quote, teaching the basics brilliantly, unquote, policy is promising to make primary and intermediate students spend at least 1 hour reading, writing and doing maths every day. It also wants to rewrite the curriculum to clearly state what must be taught in these areas each year and to test students twice yearly from year three. The party's leader, Christopher Luxon, says two-thirds of the secondary school students failed to meet minimum standards in reading, writing and maths, and 98% of decile 1 year 10 students failed a basic writing test. This in a pilot that reported last year. Well, Professor Emeritus of Educational Psychology at Mass University is James Chapman. Hello, James.
Moreno, Catherine.
We're going to focus on literacy this morning. What is your first impression on where both major parties are coming from? Obviously, the new practice model comes out of 4 years of work by an incumbent government, right, with the sector. But what do you make of how each is coming at this issue from an evidence-based perspective?
Well, I think there's actually a lot of common ground there that perhaps because of party politics, that's not being spoken about at the moment. In terms of the common practice model, I would think that National Party people would be very pleased with many aspects of the common practice model. And I think the current government and Ministry of Education would see some value in aspects of the national policy, which was released yesterday. So I think that, and I hope that there will actually be a sensible conversation that isn't sort of slashing around at everything, but actually a sensible, coherent conversation about elements that really need to be put into place in order to reverse the problems that occur with literacy and communication, as well as other aspects of performance by our children. So I think there is a lot of scope for common ground.
All right. Well, we'll hone in on those details and your particular passions in a moment. But first, can you just overview that new curriculum practice model? Look, it's big, it's thematic. It is presented in education speak, if I can put it that way, and that it needs to be. It needs to be very comprehensive. It needs to be applicable to all sorts of demographics and populations. Could you overview it for us?
Yeah, in terms of the common practice model, I was involved in the literacy and communication part of that, not the maths part, so I can't speak to the maths part of it. But the group that worked on the literacy and communication side of it included practitioners, teacher educators, and university researchers, academics. And I thought there was a very common understanding that change was needed in a number of aspects. This was a change group. And to that extent, I thought the group worked extremely well together. There were differences in terms of emphasis of what should be included in a common practice model. But I think one of the big highlights was around the section on explicit teaching. Now, unfortunately, I guess due to constraints around space, this was crunched right down. It was synthesized down into a statement that really left out a lot of the elements that were discussed by people who worked on explicit teaching. And I think that was a shame because the explicit teaching section, as was written in the report, said that the report said explicit literacy and communication teaching has been highlighted because it is a significant shift in literacy and communication teaching advice. And I think that's an extremely important takeaway that somehow or other sort of got a little bit buried. And I think that's a real shame. As the report, the Common Practice Report pointed out, explicit teaching is best used when learning is new and when learning can't be expected to be discovered by most students. And the science of reading has known this for a long time. We've been on about this for 20, 30, almost 40 years. So I think that the common practice model in regard to explicit teaching represents a very significant departure from the current approach of whole language or so-called balanced literacy, which is far from balanced.
Okay, so what will teachers get, though, that will see them apply that principle? You're talking about this massive document or series of documents that's been released. What will come through to a teacher, a classroom teacher, with respect to what they're now to do?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Catherine. And you mentioned earlier about a lot of jargon, and that's fair because the Common Practice Model report talked about a range of pedagogies that are designed to enhance learning outcomes. Now, the next step, as the Ministry has signalled, is a phase two where another group, many of whom were in the Common Practice group, will work on specific teaching advice, specific teaching processes, and specific teaching resources. And I think that is where the detail will be put into what is currently a more high order level of, principles. And so it needs to be fleshed out. I think that at the moment it is not teacher ready, but it will become teacher ready, I'm confident, once the next group works on much more specific elements that will guide and provide support for teachers.
Could you be explicit about explicit teaching, please?
Yeah, explicit teaching in the area that I focused on, which is really in the beginning reading, writing, spelling, and the junior primary school, is really getting back to what the science of reading, and reading in the sense includes writing and spelling, has been on about. And that is to teach the foundation skills that children need during their literacy learning period in those first 2 to 3 years in school. At the moment, the fortunately many schools have gone away from this, but at the moment the approach is generally based on the false idea that children will learn to read the way that we learn to speak. It's absolute rubbish. It's been discredited for a long, long time. So this sort of whole language, so-called balanced approach to literacy instruction is really just a bunch of phooey. So the explicit approach is to teach children the alphabetic principle using phonics, to teach them the fundamental language skills that are required to decode unfamiliar words that children come across when they're reading, which is what beginning reading is all about, and when they're writing, and when they're spelling. If they aren't explicitly taught these fundamental underlying language skills, then many children miss out. Some children will get it, we know that. But we also know that this approach disadvantages many children. So an explicit approach is really designed not to leave anything to chance. It's to ensure that every child across the country, everywhere, in every school, can learn to read when teachers know better how to teach reading. We know a lot of teachers want to do this. Many of them want this support. They've been wanting the support for a long time. Many teachers aren't against this. They just want the tools to teach better so that more kids benefit from early reading language instruction.
Will the progression of this common practice model, as you said, phase one is out as of this week, the high-level principles, if you like,
yes.
Principles and pedagogical approaches, which is simply pedagogy is what? Good proven practice for teaching, how to teach, right?
Yeah, pedagogies, teaching approaches. That's
okay.
Right.
So that's out. Now, phase two, as you say, will include evidence-informed practices.
Yes, that's correct.
If I am a teacher in a classroom, yet again facing the prospect of how I am going to meet my curriculum requirements and the individual needs of the children in my class and the collective needs of the children in my class, what am I going to get at the end of this? And how precise will it be? Or will it be, will the onus again be on teachers to develop resources, develop lesson plans to meet these principles? Because I want to come in a moment to what National's proposing with this idea of a resource bank. Under the current government's plans, what will you get as a teacher or the head of a syndicate or a principal at the end of this?
Yeah, I'm not involved in the next phase. And my understanding is that the purpose of the next phase is for a smaller group to work over a period of time, 3 or 4 months, to develop those very explicit teaching processes, teaching skills that classroom teachers will be able to follow in their teaching, not just in beginning reading and beginning literacy, but from early childhood through to senior secondary. So it goes beyond the area that I've been more focused on. So the goal there is to come up with very, very specific guidelines. They're not instructions as such. It's not an expectation that every classroom teacher across the country will be doing exactly the same thing at 9 o'clock every morning. The idea is to provide teaching processes that can be adapted for the specific situation that a teacher is in so that they can improve the literacy learning outcomes of all kids. So resources are meant to be a part of that as well. So you're right, it's not meant to require that teachers then have to spend time after teaching in the evenings and the weekends developing their own resources. The idea is that resources will be a part of the approach that will be taken to improve those actual teaching practices. So I'm optimistic that this next group will actually come up with something that is very tangible, that is very clearly laid out, because the people involved in developing that include classroom teachers who do these sorts of things, who do things like structured literacy, for example. They know how this works. They know that whole language balanced literacy doesn't work. And so I think that group, and I don't know all the members of the group, will come up with something very concrete and very explicit, very usable.
Let's look at National's policy, Teaching the Basics Brilliantly, as it applies to literacy. We're going to come back to maths next week, but as it applies to literacy. Is this, as has been claimed by some, a reworked National Standards approach?
I don't see it as a reworked National Standards approach. I know that there are sort of flags that get put up that lead to impulsive responses around national assessments, national testing and stuff like that. There is a role for systematic assessment that guides learning. There's an important role for that. And New Zealand hasn't done all that well for a long time. That has tended to be an anti-assessment sort of zeitgeist in New Zealand that I think is most unfortunate, because sort of diagnostic specific assessments to guide the learning process are desperately needed. And some schools are doing this extremely well. Others have yet to catch up. I don't know that there's enough detail in the National Party plan yet to come up with anything that is sensible. The idea of 1 hour a day, for example, I heard the National spokesperson, Erica Stanford, elaborate on that a little bit this morning.
It's not blocks of 1 hour, right? You're not sitting there for 1 hour at a time doing maths.
Right.
Aren't schools doing that now? Can you just explain first what National's proposing, as she elaborated on a morning report, and then also what schools do already? Because isn't the weaving of mathematical principles into everything from music to physical education part of what teachers do now?
Yes. By and large, that's right. So the issue for me isn't so much about a specific block of time or time spread. Time is spread as appropriate. I think what is more important is how that time is used, how teachers actually teach. So taking that one step further and saying, okay, maybe on average, over an hour in the course of a school day would seem reasonable for literacy and mathematics and communication. That would seem reasonable. But the bigger question is, well, how are teachers going to use that time? How will they actually teach that time so that more students benefit from it?
How do we even define reading in a digital era, by the way?
Well, reading is reading, whether it's digitized print or whether it's paper print. Children need to be able to read, regardless of whether it's in digital form or in paper form. And if children can't learn to read, then they can't read to learn. And as been pointed out in the current discussions, reading is also an integral part of mathematics learning. So whether it's digital or not, to me, is in and of itself not the key question. The key question is that children are able to read, full stop, because if they can't read, then there are many areas in which they will have enormous difficulty in learning, and we already know that through the statistics that come out about our reading performance, our literacy performance, and our mathematics performance.
Let's talk about assessment then, because if I recall correctly, National's proposing going back to annual year bands rather than, say, 3-year year bands for trying to reach certain levels of ability. Now, does that fit with our knowledge of the rates of development and the patterns of development of reading and writing for children in primary school?
Yeah, I mean, the concept in and of itself, I think, is okay, but there seems to be a knee-jerk reaction against national assessments designed to find out how well children are doing. I think with a carefully prepared assessment device that is designed to be diagnostic and also to give teachers and parents a picture of how children are progressing, I think there is definitely a role for that. And I guess I've been concerned over a number of decades now that there seems to be just an unwillingness to even entertain the idea that there should be this type of assessment, diagnostic to inform the teaching process.
Wasn't Erica Stanton's point that there's already plenty of testing going on, whether it's PA tests, she rattled off a couple of others. Does that vary from school to school?
I don't know the extent to which PA tests are used these days. I've done analyses some decades ago on PAT tests. There may be a role for something like that. I think we perhaps have moved beyond that type of assessment.
So your point is there is room for diagnostic, meaning to identify where a child is struggling. That's individualised. When we start setting targets like that 80% of Year 8 students are at or above the expected curriculum level for their age in reading, writing, maths and science by 2030, Kiwi students from the top 10 maths, reading and science as measured by PISA rankings by 2033, that's the international measure.
Yes.
Do we then get into the debate, oh, we're going to teach to test?
Yeah, I think that is often a reaction that we teach to the test, and there seems to be a practice that does occur in some countries where they have high stakes testing like those sorts of measures. However, if we're going to set goals, we need to have a method of trying to identify whether those goals are being met or not. And I think people feel somewhat threatened when goals are set about how much we should improve in literacy and mathematics and so forth. They feel threatened that, oh dear, if we have some sort of assessment to see whether those goals are being met or not, what will happen to the children who struggle to meet the goals? Well, that's a fair question. Then that's a teaching issue, a teaching solution. So, yes, if we're going to have goals, and I think we should, then we have to have some benchmark against which those goals can be measured. The type of assessment will be quite crucial. It shouldn't be high stakes, nationalised in that very, very formal sense. There should be some other way of doing these assessments that provide information both for teachers and parents, because teachers and parents deserve that information. And as a country, we need to know how we are performing so that we don't find out when the PISA scores for 15-year-olds or the PIRLS 5-yearly surveys of 9-10-year-olds come out and we think, oh dear, we keep New Zealand slipping again, it's slipping again, it's slipping again. We shouldn't be in that situation. So we need good assessment devices and instruments to show the progress that we are making and the areas in which we need to do better.
I recall last time there was a significant angsting around all this. I think it was under the previous national government, not just from the perspective of the introduction of national standards, but actually also because there was an investigation by that government into the so-called long tail of underachievement in New Zealand. And if I recall correctly also, there was a correlation with deprivation and poverty, if you like. We not only struggle with those things still today, but we also struggle with truancy rates at significant levels. Is any of this going to work if we do not address some of those fundamentals?
Yes, I agree that those fundamental issues have to be addressed regardless of the educational consequences. Just as a human rights issue, they need to be addressed. However, sometimes the impact of those factors, I think, cannot be an excuse for not doing better in schools where we have children, by and large, those who attend at least, and I know there's issues around truancy, where children are attending school for 5-6 hours a day or whatever it is. So in a study that I did in parts of Auckland, West and South Auckland, a number of years ago, teachers rated the children as to whether their homes were very challenging and whether truancy was a factor, or whether their homes were not specifically challenging. And there was very little difference between the scores of children on the assessments that I ran for children who were deemed to have come from challenging homes compared to those from non-challenging homes, which led me to conclude what is going on in the classrooms, that kids in school who regularly attend aren't doing much better than the kids who aren't attending very often and have complex issues at home. So yes, obviously poverty and school truancy are factors that will impact on learning. Hunger will impact on learning. We know these things, but some schools are doing brilliantly despite those challenges.
Okay.
And so to have a sort of a blanket cop-out, I think, is very, very unfortunate. It doesn't serve our teachers well, who are doing the best they can, and it doesn't serve our kids well.
Thank you. Professor Emeritus of Educational Psychology at Massey University, James Chapman, a specialist in literacy and a particular advocate of explicit teaching, and particularly of phonics and language decoding. We'll return to both major parties' positions as they apply to the teaching of maths in primary schools next week.